Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at cento.com, King Arthur at kingarthurflower.com, Cola Vida at colavita.com, and Wines of Portugal at winesofportugal.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey folks, Michael Omeka here. Great to be back and on time. Nice to have the L train running. Last week was, I'll tell you, I've been in New York 30 years and I've never had a train stop. And yeah, they tell you to go upstairs and figure it out for yourself, which I suppose in some parts of Manhattan might make life not so tough. But where we were in Brooklyn, it was like, you're kidding me. There ain't no cabs out here. How do I get to the station? Anyway, came early today. Trains are running on time. We had some phone line issues. They got fixed. So it's a good world. This will be the last show for me until next October, I think. I try and take the summer months, which is an extended kind of holiday, off. Spend my time down at the beach. Yeah, swimming in the ocean, having all sorts of fun. I think I mentioned last week, the week before that, on the 14th, me and two buddies did a three-man relay swim around Key West. It was lots of fun. We trained for it all winter and did it in 5 hours, 26 minutes, which was enough to get a second place. So congratulations to Frank Coco, Don Speranza, my swimming mates. A long swim, hot water, hot air, but lots and lots of fun. Let's get into the show today. We'll skip the usual lengthy preamble. We've got a really good one. I've got some super solid guests lined up. My first guest in a minute or two is Ellen Gustafson, who is, I don't know how to pigeonhole people, but in a broad sense of the word, she's kind of a food activist. If you Google her name, it's Gustafson. There's a TED Talk there that's great. There's a whole bunch of stuff. She's one of these... I guess I'm allowed to say young kids, whatever that term means anymore, who's just really somehow could have gone in another era, would have done something else. She would have been into medicine or finance or who knows what other, maybe social causes. But there's all these smart, brilliant types getting into the food space today, and for the good of the planet. She has a new book just out called We the Eaters. So we're going to have a discussion with her. I'm going to bring in Patrick Martins, who is one of the founders of Slow Foods USA. He also owns Heritage Foods, based here in New York City. I remember Patrick and Sarah O'Brightis and the whole early Heritage Foods crew when they just got started and they were driving around the farms in a rented van and picking up meat from slaughterhouses and driving it back to New York City and selling it to chefs like Mario Batali and others that would pay the premium for heritage breeds and farm-raised animals. Well, his business has grown substantially since then, and he has a book out now called The Carnivore's Manifesto. And if we can, we'll try and arrange through the genius of engineering to have Ellen and Patrick's interviews kind of dovetail. I'd like them both on microphone with me for a bit because I think they share the same space. But anyway, let me get started with... and one more guest at the end, sorry. Anna Polonsky is going to come in at a little past the bottom of the hour to talk about this great kind of French youth movement that started in France and now it's moved into the States maybe 6 or 7 years ago, called Le Fooding. And it's kind of breaks down barriers between chefs and restaurants and the audience. It's kind of like one of those cool youth movements where they combine chefs from France with chefs from whatever host cities that they're in to have these parties that are sort of multifaceted with musical entertainment, audio, video entertainment, all sorts of stuff going on. And they call it Le Fooding. And it's pretty cool. I mean, it's one of these new youth based, I don't want to say hipster because that can be a pejorative in some people's mind. Well, at least it isn't mine. But yeah, they're cool. So she's going to talk about Le Fooding New York 2014, what they're doing, when the events take place, what it's about in a better way than I just did. Anyway, Ellen Gustafson, do I have you?
Yes, you do. Hi.
Sorry. It took me, I said I'd be quick and I wasn't. That's normal. Anyway, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Talk about what you're doing. I mean, what you've been doing and what drew you to this? Because, again, I'm sorry if I misrepresented. I didn't want, but you kind of remind me. There was a while I used to do a radio show in New York called Food Talk, the WOR broadcast for years. And 6 years I had to run at that. And it was like, you know, 5 days, 6 days a week job. And I had a lot of guests on. And I kept meeting these like young, like late 20s, 30, 31 year old kids that like went to NYU and under Marion Nestle got their master's in food something. I think you create your own, you know, degree curricula. What drove you to the world of food? You're working at the UN, is that it?
You know, yeah, actually though, before then, which is kind of a little bit of a circuitous path, I was living in New York and working on terrorism issues. And, you know, of course, in New York, when 9/11 happened, that kind of helped set me on my path to look into, you know, why was this happening and why are people so angry and why are they attacking us? And I really got into food through looking at security and seeing the connection between places around the world that are, you know, wild and tend towards birds and the places around the world that are hungry, and saw sort of an interesting link between those two places. And that's kind of what drove me to get into first hunger, but then more broadly food.
You're on a cell phone, I take it.
Yeah.
Okay, because the connection is kind of, we'll bear with it. Maybe if you move around, we'll find a better space, because on our end, it's making a ton of noise. But anyway, so talk about, this is really interesting, and I've had, over the years, had a lot of guests from Michael Pollan to you name it, on the various shows I've hosted on the radio, and there's this funny disconnect. We have on this great planet of ours, a billion people that wake up every day hungry, that their challenge is to get enough calories that day to feed them, their children and themselves. Some days they do, some days they don't, but every day it's a challenge. So that's a billion people on one end. Then we have a billion people on the other end of the planet that we're pretty familiar with if you live in America and look around, who are obese. Talk about that disconnect, how it happens, what we can do about that.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what inspired me to write this book, is the idea that, you know, we have this dual problem, both related to how we nourish ourselves. And, you know, I think what I eventually came to is that American eaters have incredible power in this food system. We really have, you know, dictated in many ways what the world eats. Our diet has spread literally around the world, and that's connected to both people in other parts of the world who are dealing and struggling with obesity, and also people that are still struggling with hunger. You know, we have systems that we use to help feed the hungry planet that in some ways are better for us than they are for people who are hungry. And I really saw the linkages in traveling, especially in the hungry world, between what we eat in America and how that eventually impacts people literally on the other side of the planet.
Yeah, so I guess we can bore down a little bit. Let's talk about, there's no way to get the politics out of this. So we have, America is blessed with these great plains that used to be home to wild grasses and herds of buffalo before we decided to kill nearly all of the buffalo in the mid-1800s and turn those verdant grasses almost in the last 50 years into endless rows of corn, soya, and wheat. Talk about modern agriculture, big agro, problematic agriculture, and how you think we can find a solution between America's amazing ability to produce these grains so cheaply, and getting those grains either distributed around the world to people need them, or helping agriculture in, say, sub-Saharan Africa.
Well, you know, what's happened more and more, especially in the last 30 and 40 years, are two things that interface our agricultural systems and those of people in the developing world. One is that we've started, because we can grow so much corn, soy, and wheat, we've shifted to giving people food. Instead of, you know, teaching a man to fish, we've been really sending our excess corn, soy, and wheat overseas. And that in many ways has stabilized local food systems and local agricultural systems in places that are hungry. And then in sort of more recent years, as the international aid community has realized, hey, you know, it'd be better if we do start, again, teaching people to fish or teaching people to grow food for themselves, what we've tended to teach them to grow is this corn, soy, wheat sort of, you know, monocropping system that I would say we now know hasn't done a great job of feeding us here at home when you look at our health issues and our obesity crisis. And so therefore probably isn't the right, you know, monolithic solution for how we should help the world feed itself.
Right. And not to mention the fact that a lot of those seeds now are owned by companies like Monsanto that also control the fertilizer, that because of the fertilizers and because of the monocrop feeding, we're really ripping apart the soil and the topsoil. I mean, it's a disservice to the planet for sure what Big Agra has done. And on the flip side, I think I always talk to about this point of how we have these. In America, it's almost the opposite. You think of sub-Saharan Africa or countries like Guatemala where there's lots of farming, but a lot of what they farm is exported and the people end up living on a diet that's almost exclusively too rich on beans, which is not good for kids, not good for development, not good for growth. And in America, we have the other problem, which is calories are so cheap here because of big farming, the commodity system, that when I was a kid, you know, you went to buy a soda, and it was most likely an 8-ounce can of Coke. It cost whatever it cost, and that was a portion. Now my kids go out with a dollar bill, so adjusted for inflation, and they're given 32 ounces of some kind of slop sweetened with high fructose corn syrup. You can buy fast food everywhere, snack food everywhere. It's, you know, 67% of America is now considered clinically obese. It's crazy.
Well, and the sad thing is, you know, there's this kind of infamous quote by a Coke executive who said Coca-Cola is now available in more countries than are recognized by the UN. And there's, of course, the badge of pride that goes with that from the company's perspective. But if you think about it, it's not only our kids that are getting soda, it's literally kids all around the world. And, you know, in my travels, I was so frustrated in seeing young people that maybe were hungry in the last generation, but maybe now have just some slim resources. You know, the easiest thing for them to buy in most parts of every corner of the planet is that Coca-Cola or that bag of chips. It's not nutritious food that we know everybody needs to eat to be healthy. And, you know, I argue it's a system that we build. It's not just individual choices. It's a system that we all live in, like you said. Easiest options right now are the least healthy, and that's the part we have to work on addressing.
Moving forward, you had mentioned, or I'd read something that you'd mentioned, or I'd seen it in one of your TED Talks, these sort of 30-year cycles that you'd like to think of. How would you like to see... two questions. How would you like to see the American system change for the better? And I guess kind of what I'm leading towards, and when I bring in my next guest, Patrick Martins, we'll talk about going back to small farms, going back, if we could, to organic that sort of means something, crop rotations, probably eating less protein because the protein will become more expensive, living off of more vegetables, but in a way sort of dismantling the system as it exists today in America. That's question number one. And then how do you see a big area like the various countries in sub-Saharan South Africa solving their hunger issues? And I guess there's two questions. You can answer them in any order you want.
Well, I mean, I argue that they're incredibly linked, that if we get the systems right here at home, and we are, you know, in 2010, I gave a TED Talk talking about what I thought would be sort of a 30-year process of changing the system in a better direction after a 30-year process that took us in the wrong direction. But what's been interesting is that in the last even 4 years, things have happened much more rapidly. You know, people have become much more knowledgeable about where their food comes from. You know, products that you would never have imagined would decline, like diet soda, are on the decline. Even a couple days ago, there was an article about how margarine is really on the decline because people are realizing that a little bit less of, you know, well-produced, healthier, well-raised cows produced butter is probably better than chemically produced margarine. And so it's been interesting to see how rapid the changes have been. And you know, even down to the agricultural system, how many Americans everywhere in our country have embraced farmers markets, have embraced community-supported agriculture, have tried to invest more of their time, cooking, and resources in food. And so I think that's actually part of the answer when we look around the planet to see these areas of chronic hunger. If we can get our systems right, we can then export those healthier systems abroad. And a couple of examples, you know, that we've seen it in the developing world are, you know, first of all, things like fair trade products, where Americans are starting to realize that our coffee, our sugar, our bananas, the price of those things sometimes doesn't include paying the workers, who many of whom are hungry, in a fair way. So I think more Americans are becoming aware of how our dollars directly impact. Then in the system, you know, the broader perspective, if we're investing in these more local agricultural systems here at home, like grow more diverse crops, you know, have more biodiversity for the farmers' fields and for us, that's also what we're working on investing in overseas. And more you see smaller nonprofits investing in, you know, varied agricultural systems, helping farmers grow more traditional crops. All of those things, I think, are part of actually the same solution for our problems here at home that is needed for problems overseas.
Thanks. Great couple of points. We're having, unfortunately, with cell phone connections are really bad, and your phone's kind of morphing out. Sounds like an old episode of Star Trek, and you're out there floating in space. So you don't have a landline we can dial you back in on, do you?
Sorry?
You don't have a landline that we can dial you back in on, do you?
I don't. Being a millennial, I don't.
Okay, sorry about that. You were wonderful, but the connection's kind of fading here. So thanks so much. Ellen Gustafson has been my guest. The name of her book, which just came out this past month, is called We the Eaters. Again, her last name is spelled G-U-S-T-A-F-S-O-N. Google her. You can see her in TED Talks. You can read about the great work that she does. Keep up the great work that you're doing. We're cheering for you, and we're all on the same page with this. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ellen. All right, there we are, folks. We got another guest coming in here in a second, Patrick Martins, who I believe is in the studio. I think I can see him. Patrick, you want to come on in? Come on. We don't have a segue. We don't have any music. We just bring you in. You know, this is sure. Like old school radio.
Is this live?
We're live. Hey. We're bum rushing you. We don't even need these. We don't need the headphones if you don't want to wear them.
No, I like wearing them.
Okay, this way you can hear
it's
yourself.
Like a comfort thing. It's like a blanket.
Well, yeah. We used to, in the old days, and we got phone calls. We needed them, but here we don't. Anyway, first of all, congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Did you make it around the Cape?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We swam around. Thank you. Yeah, 2 weeks ago. It was gnarlier swim than... Don't ask me why I didn't think it was going to be gnarly, but because you're going in a complete circle around mm-hmm. a 12.5-mile island, you're swimming through 3 or 4 different bodies of water, mm-hmm. so you've got completely different currents to deal with, boat traffic. We swam through a marina at one point uh-huh. for like 2 miles with boats that were moored, boats that were pulling out. 298 people started the race. Everybody finished.
Oh, wow.
And we came in second in the men's three-way, which was amazing.
Wow.
5 hours, 26 minutes. So we held... 29-minute miles, 28-minute miles the whole way.
I've never been part of a men's three-way.
Oh, stop. Easy does it. Anyway, let's talk about the book. It's hysterical. So, Patrick Martins, M-A-R-T-I-N-S. He's the founder of Heritage Foods here in New York City. And tell me about the Slow Food Connection, because you're the founder of what? Slow Foods New York, Slow Foods USA?
Well, at the beginning, Slow Food didn't... I mean, most people didn't even have internet. When we first started, I mean, people maybe had access to the internet, but they weren't looking to email for daily updates like we do today. So, I mean, it was kind of like the late medieval times is when I came to Slow Food, and I brought it to my apartment in New York City with Serena Diliberto, who I still work with, and we ran it from here, and we grew it to about 10,000 members and 100 chapters, but they were still loosely connected, and most of the main projects were still coming from the national office and the international office. Now, of course, Slow Food's evolved into, you know, a multifaceted organization that's different in different cities. But when I was there, it was, you know, really the first wave of members, you know, the first mm-hmm. foodies or
what
whatever
year?
You want to call them.
To
1998, I went over there.
Okay.
And then I started the national office here in March of 2000.
So you were in Italy in 98 and you opened up the national office. That's a long time ago.
Yeah. They were still, it's great to see people like you and, who are still around, who've been there all the time. You know, Steve Jenkins is another guy.
Yes, he's great. Cheesemonger at Fairway from way, way back in the day.
Garrett Oliver. I mean, these are all
Brooklyn
people
Brewery.
Slugging it out for 20 years.
Yeah. Talk about what drew you, because I don't know if I've ever asked you this, but so you're a Manhattan-born and bred kid.
Yep.
What drew you? Obviously, at 98, you were into the food scene. Talk about when you started Heritage Foods, what that was about, and why you felt the need to do that.
Thank you so much.
Okay, he's got a
that is awesome.
Calzone and a beer, I think.
Yeah.
He's
well, it is 3 o'clock, burritos. Right?
It is 3 o'clock. That's true. And beers, you could drink beer for breakfast, I think.
You could. So what drew me to Heritage Foods? Well, there was a lot of talk, basically. A lot of people talked about what they wanted to do, but they didn't necessarily do it. And then there was a huge lack of education. I mean, listen, obviously, I love the New York Times. I mean, I subscribe to it. I read it every day. It's the best paper in the history of the world. They had a hamburger article that was 10,000 words. Not one sentence was dedicated to provenance of the meat. They talked about percentages and brioche buns and, like, how is it that in every recipe it calls for the historical history and the date it came to America for the grains and for the vegetables and for the heirloom seeds. And in a 10,000-word article about hamburger meat, the breed or the terroir or the land or anything having to do with provenance was not given one sentence.
What year?
This came out 2 days ago, the burger article. And anyway, it's just
I didn't even read that article because
you were away.
No, and the burger's just been so like written no. like.
But anyway, it's
just
a great article.
Ozersky's canon. That's enough for me. Like forget fucking burgers.
But anyway, it's a great article. But now we are at a time in our lives where meat deserves the same attention as we give anything else. You know, within the food world, wine. Beer. I mean, we're talking about that. This is a German style from Stuttgart in 1637, and it was brought here by this, and now there's 7 breweries in America. And then when it comes to the meat part of a recipe, it's and a 32-ounce skirt steak. You know, it just needs a little bit more, but we still live in that time. So that's part of the two reasons why I started Heritage Foods.
So you came on my radar in, you correct me if I'm wrong, it was 06 or 07. I was at WOR. It was just before Thanksgiving, maybe the first weekend of November of that year. And I don't think it was Florence Fabricant, but it was front page above the fold of the Wednesday Times. Mm-hmm. And the story on Frank Reese and his turkeys. Yep. And I remember thinking, wow, this is interesting. Here's this guy who's like the turkey savant who's in the middle of nowhere. And I kind of just heard of you through the grapevine as supplying restaurants because you were just beginning to do that. And you tell the story at this point, because whoever planted that, it was the beginning of throwing a match on the fire of Heritage. I just think it so helped you sell sell Frank's turkeys that year. But you talk about it. Tell us a little background about Frank, that story, and give me the context of the year if I was wrong.
Well, basically, you know, this was covered in the book. The turkey that most Americans eat had its beak cut off. It never saw the light of day. The lights were left on to make it eat the whole time. You know, turkeys are naturally picky eaters. Their instinct is to roost. That's how they sleep. You hear about roosting. What is that? That's where they clamp their claws on like a stick or something and fall asleep. So that instinct is removed from them, the ability to fulfill it. So that's like basically forcing humans to sleep in a standing up position. And the lights never go off. And then they're overbred. They're forced. They've gotten so good at what they do through artificial insemination that this bird has been pushed to grow much faster than God meant it to. And it's cardiovascular, skeletal. It's like bruising. It's obese, you know, and it lives a very short life. Who's eating that turkey?
Everybody. Right.
So that's fine. I mean, and they do mostly dominate, but we needed to launch an alternative. And Frank Reese actually had these old genetics. Now, he comes to it, of course, from the pasture and no antibiotics, which, by the way, they have to feed subtherapeutically to keep those animals alive. How that became acceptable, no one knows. Low doses of medicine.
70s. The biggest end user of pharmaceutical antibiotics in America is the feed industry.
Yeah. Big companies have to become better farmers is basically the in and out of that one. But so Frank Reese came to it from the genetics because he believed that where the big industrial farms were failing – even more than the confinement issue and the antibiotics, was that they were overbreeding their turkeys to be pushed. It would be as if, you know, in Planet of the Apes, they bred us to become obese because they eat it, and so all humans were obese. I mean, it's really wrong. So he raised all these old breeds from the 1860s and 1850s, and they were certified by the quote-unquote American Poultry Association. So we're like, we got to get these into the market because no one's really getting them into the market on a national level. So Marion Burroughs wrote an original article
in
2002, but Kim Severson was a big supporter of it too and wrote about it numerous times. And basically, he went from 800 to 1600 to 2400 to now he raises about 10,000 of these. And as you say, it was a real catalyst to the point where Marion Burse and I spoke. She was a guest on my show, The Main Course. And she says, now I can drive to the end of my road on Thanksgiving and some guy's selling a heritage turkey that didn't exist 20 years ago. So it was her catalyst, Frank's know-how, and my ability to be connected to people.
And those turkeys, I remember from that article, they weren't coming frozen. The deal was you order them up to such and such a date, and you could pick them up Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, before Thanksgiving, and that was it. Yeah. Shit ton of work, shit ton of distribution.
Well, it was a high maintenance day, for sure.
Yeah.
And then we would mail order 2,000 or 3,000 via FedEx to people around the country.
I get them when I'm in Cape May. Because to me, it was always ironic. You know, Thanksgiving is our only real national culinary holiday. Everything else we inherited, or it's fake, or it's whatever. Mm-hmm. Thanksgiving is a pure American thing, and we celebrate by, you know, eating maybe one of the shittiest proteins you can have, which is these pre-frozen, horribly overbred birds that have been sitting in a warehouse somewhere for 12 months or longer.
We don't have a harvest day, though. That would be a great day. One of the chapters in the book, it's 50 short chapters, calls for August 1st to be National Farmers Day. And we were annoyed that the groundhog in Pennsylvania gets more attention than collectively all our farmers in America. So it's the slowest in spirit month of the year, August 1st. First, and Jimmy Carbone, our fellow co-host of Beer Sessions, is trying to get Green Market to declare a national day. Think about it. I mean, a harvest day, all our farmers, one day, one more national holiday.
Great idea. So you've just written a book. That's why we're here. The Carnivore's Manifesto. It's your first book.
And my wife wanted to call it The Carnifesto.
That's not bad. Yeah. Who made the decision? The publisher? They always do.
That's ridiculous.
They always do. So we talked about, it's funny, I had talking notes, but it's almost like I never use them. But we did talk about one of the things I want to talk about. So a couple of years, 2000, 2001, I was out at the French Laundry shooting for our second season of our PBS series. I was out in San Francisco with Alice Waters. We did Compton Place. We did a bunch of wineries. And we spent a couple of days at the French Laundry while we were there to get three shows out of it. And Thomas was real generous, as he always is, with his time. I could walk around the kitchen. I had full access to everything. So I went in the walk-in box. And in the walk-in box, he's got black bass, which are from Long Island or the coast of New Jersey. Mm. He's got lobster from Maine. He's got fresh hearts of palm from Hawaii. And, you know, he's in California, where sort of the, quote, locavore movement kind of got its start with Chez Panisse. And I asked him, so talk about this. And what I'm leading to is your chapter called To Hell with Local. He said, Mike, you know,
it was called Fuck Local, Eat the Best, but we changed it to Hell with Local. It was like an 11th hour change.
Well, his comment, which I think, you know, as an ex-chef and an ex-restaurant guy, at the end of the day, you're cooking for your customers, you're cooking for your audience, if you're paying X amount of dollars with expectations, let them eat the best.
The best.
And these days, with the advent of FedEx and UPS and you know, the network of shipping, you can do this. So talk about that, because I think that was great, because I think some of your writing here is really contrarian to the sort of the mainstream.
Like eating endangered species, what the hell does he mean?
Yeah.
And then to hell with local. Well, you're absolutely right, and I was inspired by some of those chefs who came out against that locavore thing. Slow food was never originally about that.
Right.
Actually, Alice Waters was never originally about that. She knew locally that they had the potential to grow most of the stuff because of the unbelievable climate that they have there. But she was no stupid person. She would be bringing in the best olive oil that she needed to. But she tried to launch it locally, but she would go to New Zealand if they did something much better. You know, for her, the organic thing. But I think everyone was, and even in ancient Rome, they were bringing stuff all over the place. I mean,
well, if you think of it, I mean, how the spice trades, because that's the story of the world and food and history.
Yeah. And essentially, you know, my wife's a cheesemonger, and we would taste a lot of local cheese, and then likewise, there'd be a lot of meats, and we would taste them together. And we never wanted to, because we're both independent merchants, to prop up what we knew to be a third or fourth rate product.
Just because it was local.
Because of a distance.
Right.
You know, we would rather be like Alice and have them taste, for instance, let's say if it's a grating cheese, Parmigiano Reggiano, and say, are you competing with this? Or maybe you're not the grating cheese guy, because Parmigiano Reggiano is the best cheese in the world. And, you know, how could you be the best at something? And so that was a big thing. And, you know, we love you know, Belgian beers, but sometimes you don't want one made in Brooklyn. You want the Trappist ones from Belgium. And, you know, Guinness with wine, we understand that, but with anchovies too. Someone just might have that. I know we have that in common, that we like anchovies.
Yeah. I buy yours when I'm in South Jersey.
And if it's a rare breed, you know, we want that too. If it's the red wattle pig that is bred to stand up to Creole cuisine in the 18th century, and we're going to do crawfish and we want pork with it, that's the one to get. And, you know, rather than trying to disguise or, you know, have an article come out that doesn't mention provenance, really the way it should be is that there's like gastronomic charts that talk about the taste attributes of all the breeds of cow, yeah, all the breeds of goat.
There's a wonderful book, Rowan Jacobson wrote it a while back, called, yeah, American Terroir.
Yes.
I remember having him on the radio at WOR.
Me too.
Really good writer, really good story. Talked about oysters, talked about that sense of place, and in a way that Americans had never embraced it. We understand terroir as being something that exists maybe in Burgundy or in Bordeaux with wines, or in Italy with Nebbiolo, but in America, no. And the answer is, why the fuck not?
Well, I mean, it's a desire to... it's a lack of understanding, although that's changing so rapidly.
Yeah.
I think it's essentially already changed. To be the gastronomic mosaic, the way France is like a gastronomic tapestry of all these things, we have to start looking ourselves as a nation and acknowledge brilliance where it exists. Like Ojai, Western Michigan, Georgia. That's 1, 2, 3 for a lot of fruits and stuff like that, avocados. And then, you know, wine, you can get them from all 50 states. But if three of them are producing world best wines for cheap prices, I mean, not to say that they need to be cheap, but, you know, that's where we should be. So it's not to hurt local economies. It's more to encourage, like Alice did, local economies to do the thing that they're best at.
Smart. My guest, Patrick Martins, we're talking about what he's been doing basically his whole adult life, and more importantly and most recently, his book, The Carnivore's Manifesto. We're going to take a quick spot to give some shout-outs to some of the underwriters that make this show possible and the other show possible, and to remind everybody that for the next few weeks, we are in the midst of a Heritage Radio Network summer fundraiser. Much of what I do in the world of food journalism exists on a nonprofit basis. I've had a PBS show that's going to launch nationally this year on Create TV starting in September. We'll be in 78% of the U.S. households. We've been locally really popular here in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Philadelphia. Big industry insider show. I don't get paid to do that show. I've got to raise money to do it. That's the PBS model. That's the same model that we have here at Heritage Radio. So if you could log on, if you like the show, and I think Heritage is great, 5-year-old network that really started as kind of a dream with just a couple of shows. Who knew who was listening? You go fast forward 5 years, and they've got 7 days of almost all-day broadcasting, some great, great hosts, great shows, and specifically boring down into the world of food, food politics, beverages. If you're a foodie around the country and really around the world, you listen. We'd love you to come on and log on to heritageradionetwork.org and donate a couple of dollars the same way you do for PBS. Patrick mentioned the New York Times. I pay for my prescription. I read it every day online. I still buy my Sunday Times paper because I like holding a piece of paper. But, you know, if you want good information, it doesn't come free. If you want crap, then you can watch Fox News and listen to all the other shit out there on the radio. So, again, we'd love you to become a member. If you like this, go to our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and find out how you can contribute. Again, here are some underwriters that make my show possible and the others, and we'll be back with Patrick Martins for another probably 10 minutes or so, and then I'll have Anna Polonsky come on to talk about Le Fooding right after this. So if you want to make a great tomato sauce, where do you start? Start with great canned tomatoes. And what are the best? What's the gold standard? What do the best Italian restaurants use, you think? San Marzano tomatoes from southern Italy. You know, I've heard of San Marzano tomatoes, loved them, heard the whole legend thing, knew they were delicious, but I wanted to go visit the region. So sometime back, I don't know, 06, 07, we went to San Marzano in the middle of the packing season in August. They've got a really long growing season. Starts early spring, April, May, and runs all the way through October because the weather down there is beautiful. You're along the the coastline of Naples there, in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius, and these are really small family farms, really small, like a half an acre apiece, and that's how they make a living, is harvesting these tomatoes. But what makes them great is the typicity of everything, the style of the tomato. It's kind of a long tomato with a really thin skin, super fleshy, super sweet tasting off the vine. We can Cento San Marzano tomatoes in the prime of the season, which is August. They just slow production down, handpick everything. Those little basil leaves, yeah, they're all put in there by hand as well. It is the best canned tomato I've ever had, and you're going to love them too. There's a reason chefs love these things. They're San Marzano authorized from the beginning. The factory gets inspected every year. Hey, you want to make great tomato sauce at home? Start with great tomatoes. Cento San Marzano. That's what I use. Hey, folks, Mike Calameco here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use, you know, try to make money in the restaurant business. So, you know, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelves. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy, but what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just bought on price. Commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants wherever I was hanging my chef's toque. And that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil. So my first trip to Portugal was 2013. It was a wine trip. A bunch of us flew over and toured the country top to bottom. Fell in love with the place. The food, the wine, the scenery, everything. Had to come back, which I did in 14 to film. And this time, 8 days in country, top to bottom again. Food, wine, surfing, what's not to love? If you've never been to Portugal, it's an extraordinary place. Buffered on one side by the Atlantic Ocean, you've got great seafood, great wines growing in all those regions. You go a little inland, you've got more great food, incredible wine country. Of course, Port is the birthplace of ports up the Douro. But my takeaway was, I thought I'd had a lot of varietals. I could keep a list of 130, 135 varietals I've had over my life. Portugal has 250 of its own indigenous wine varietals. And they're killer good. A lot of them have been growing there for centuries. It has some of the oldest viticulture in Europe. The sparkling wines from the Bijada, the great reds coming down south from those regions. What's not to love? Crisp whites, beautiful full-bodied reds, port wine, sparkling wine. So if you're not familiar with the wines of Portugal, next time you stop by at your local wine store, ask about them. I love them. I'm drinking a lot of them these days, and I think you will too.
King Arthur Flour, established in 1790, is America's oldest flour company. They're an employee-owned company whose passion is sharing the joy of baking and inspiring bakers worldwide. When King Arthur was founded in 1790, George Washington was the newly elected president of the United States. The company was sold by the Sands family to King Arthur Flour employees in 1996. They are now an ESOP company, 100% employee-owned, with a 100% commitment to quality. Visit them at kingarthurflour.com.
I'm Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. This summer, Heritage Radio Network is turning 5. Since our launch in 2009, we've continued to bring you food and culture content like nobody else. And we need your help. Heritage Radio Network is a passionate, grassroots, action-oriented, nonprofit organization. That means we depend on the support from listeners like you to keep us alive. If you love what you hear on Heritage Radio Network, visit our website and become a member today. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
Five. Okay, beautiful. Hey, welcome back, folks.
I love that music.
Yes.
What are those, snare drums? What do they call
those little things, those little Caribbean kind of things?
It's like upside down garbage cans.
Yeah, those things. It's like what you hear in Florida and at the bars. Actually, I don't want to tell you about the bars where I was. But anyway, Patrick Martins is my guest. Heritage Radio Network is what you're listening to. Food Talks, the show. We 5 minutes. We'll go real fast, like bullet point questions. It's a great book.
I'll answer everything in one word.
One word. One word. Three sentences or less. The Carnivore's Manifesto. It's Patrick Martin's book. It's basically 100-and-some essays, real short, 2-3 pages each. It's funny. It's like his rants on things. So I have said this a million times that I'd love to see people, and I think this is what we have to do. Eat better protein, spend way more money on it because it's going to cost a lot more money to raise cattle, pigs, chickens, everything the right way. Buy good stuff, eat less of it. Commodity versus quantity. Talk about that. That's one of your chapters.
Commodity versus quality. Yeah, we I'm sick to death of going to sustainable food conferences and they're like, okay, we're going to open today. We're going to really change the world. Should we be eating meat or not? I'm like, come on, I'm ready to walk out. And the first thing on the opening line of a conference, and I might have paid to go on a trip there or had belief in it, Slow Food might be making an exception. They have a thing called Slow Meat where they're trying to launch businesses. But we eat 11 billion livestock a year in this country. So let's start engaging an alternative. And should we eat less meat? Yes, you know, probably because you know, we should be eating less commodity meats. So, of course, everyone's like, well, your $140 turkey, how can everyone afford that? But I went through the laundry list of terrible things that happened to the turkey in the first part of the interview. No one should be arguing for the consumption of that turkey by anyone. Now, of course, it's about the slow turning of the wheel because I just had a ham and cheese croissant and God knows where that ham came from. And I don't even ever want to know where pepperoni comes on pizza because it's too delicious. I don't want to mess with it. But the point is it's about a slow turning of the wheel, and we should be eating less meat and eating better meat. Right. No one should be arguing for the consumption of cheap meat, especially to poor people, you know, who have a host of other concerns to worry about other than failing health because of their diet. So we should be eating less, and we should also be looking, for instance, to the Italians. 2 ounces of pasta, of red meat, ground meat, on a pasta, which fills easily a person, and it's delicious. That's, what is that, $3 a person? $4 a person?
Yeah, eat better and eat less of it and eat more vegetables. I mean, it's really simple. It's not rocket science.
And then it's like I said about the turkey, to answer your question. You know, they overgrow. They do these terrible things to these animals. We need to be responding to that and supporting a more humane system. Nyman Ranch did it many decades ago. You know, D'Artagnan leads the way in grass and fowl and this and that. Heritage is doing it with pork and turkeys. You know, we need to be asking questions of our meat purveyors because ultimately we put that meat in our mouth. We need to be intimate with the supply.
Last 2 points, and this one I thought was funny. I was kind of laughing reading this on the beach. You know, go to a restaurant today, and the server comes out, and it's, you know, so here's the menu, and here's what we're doing, and we have the house-made sopressata, we have the house-made this, we make our mozzarella fresh for service, and for our burger that's made out of these various meats that we could tell you about, we have house-made ketchup. So I remember years ago, one of the greatest French chefs of his generation, Joel Robuchon, had a restaurant called Germain that was a 3-star Michelin restaurant for its entire existence.
In Paris.
And Joel stepped down at 50 to retire because it was just exhausting to do that 3-star dance. But when Joel first discovered Heinz ketchup, he was like, fucking genius.
Done.
Yeah, I'm done. Like, I'm done. This is on my menu somehow or other. And he used it. That's just a funny chapter. Talk about that.
Don't make your own ketchup. Well, I was introduced to the idea by Marion Cunningham. Everything Alice Waters said I took as gold because she was the chapter leader of the most important chapter of the nation when I was the head of Slow Food. And she's like, oh, you make this, how you make mayonnaise and blah, blah, blah. And then one time she was at a conference with Marion Cunningham, who was James Beard's personal assistant while he was
brilliant.
Alive.
Great
she
writer.
Went on to do, I think she just passed away. And she was like, what I just heard out of Alice's mouth was outrageous. Don't ever make your own mayo. Buy Hellman's and let that be the end of it. And it really turned me on to this idea that why improve on a commodity when it's the best of its kind. So, for instance, your oyster wants Tabasco sauce. What's better than Worcester sauce than Liam Perrin's? Right. And if you're going to make an egg cream, you'd be an ass not to use Fox's.
Right. Last one, and please, I try and give a shout out to this all the time. Slow down thing. I'm of that generation where, you know, it was these fucking smartphones. I mean, it's amazing what you could do. We talked about it. I often think as I'm Googling random shit when I'm bored, how when I was a kid, you went to the library, you pull out the fucking card catalog, you wrote your thing on a piece of paper, you went upstairs into the racks, you hopefully found the book you were looking for, and then you sat down. It was like exhausting to like get shit done. But that's how the world up until like 10 minutes ago, that's how it was done.
Did you receive emails on your swim around Florida, the Keys? Did you do any type of texting or anything from the water?
I don't even have my phone. I don't carry my phone with me. I am like such a retard. I'm like, right. So, I mean, this is great, and then I'll let you go. Talk about the slow down thing, because I think it's so true.
Well,
I mean, it's
basically
great, but it's like a conundrum.
We call for the slowing down. What we really call for is there used to be guides of all types, yellow pages, white pages,
phone booths,
this and that. So we're calling for the, even though some trees are going to suffer, the actual publication of a hardcore farmer, like the Farmer's Almanac, but we want to model it after the Whole Earth catalog.
I remember 1968. I remember those first ones, man.
It was essentially the Google of its time. It was all mail order. If you could operate an envelope and a stamp, you could be engaged with all these self-empowering tools, whether it was an encyclopedia on Rocky Mountain edible plants or a porta shower that allowed you to go camping. It was everything you needed to know. It was vetted by a group of people at the editor. And it was signed by who gave it the recommendation, so it was immune to false Yelpers and click trends and this and that. And if you fucked up and you made a terrible product one year, you were out. And it was just great. And it was a huge magazine, and you know, bigger than any shelf on a bookshelf. But reading it could entertain you for years. And they, you know, I think we need another one like that today to launch the food revolution, whether it's nitrogen maker, you know, whatever, sous vide machines or, you know, knives for slaughterhouses. We need to be mail ordering this stuff and creating our own solutions to removing ourselves from the industrial grip.
Patrick Martins, thanks for coming on. Thanks for the work that you do. The name of the book is The Carnivore's Manifesto. It's really funny, and it's 70 or 80 two-and-a-half-page rants, just like Patrick did now.
Thank you for doing the show with us and for
having
me on. It's always fun to listen to your show. It's really exciting every time I listen.
Thank you so much. Listening to Heritage Radio Network, my next guest is in studio waiting patiently. Anna Polonsky, how are you?
It doesn't change with you,
huh? No, that was great. We've had her on. We had her on in the Big House at WOR, I think, a couple of years ago. Thanks, Patrick. Anna, welcome back.
Hello.
So, I don't know how many years ago I had you on, 5 or 6 or whatever. Just new audience. Talk about what Le Fooding is, when it started, where it started, why it started, and then I'll shut up and tell us kind of where it's moved today, and then at some point I'll ask you what's happening this summer with the events, because it's really cool. But start kind of with Le Fooding 101.
Sure. So, Le Fooding started 14 years ago now, and it started in Paris. And at the time in Paris, there was only the Michelin Guide, basically. So, no one was really talking about the new generation of chef, younger, not using tablecloths, you know, less fancy service, etc. So Le Fooding, which was a guide at first, was the first media to speak about this young generation. And really the idea, and it's still the idea for anything we do, media or events, was to promote more open-minded and less codified, also less foodie approach on food. It's always about putting food in a more accessible and cultural perspective, you know, and we always mix food with graphic design and artists and art spaces. So that's the philosophy.
It seemed like I first visited France as a young New York cook because my chef's mentors were all French chefs. And, you know, you had to go to France in the summer and you had this time off. So you had to go eat at the 3-star restaurants and the bistro. And it was just love at first sight. I mean, what a culture. It was just amazing to me. The ingredients were so much better over there. The cooking was amazing across the board, all through the little town. It didn't matter where you went. And then when I went back 20 years later, it was almost depressing because it seemed like a coffin. It seemed like nothing had changed. And during that 20 years in America, we were on fire. Suddenly, the ingredients here that the chefs got to play with were as good, maybe better, from cheese to butter to bread to mushrooms to all the things that we were talking about with Patrick. So there was this need for this movement because the French are so, I mean, the last big thing that happened was Nouvelle Cuisine, and that was the goddamn 60s.
Exactly.
They're so traditional. That's a criticism. They're sort of stuck. And so this was a way to break out of that.
Totally. And Le Fooding founder, Alex, who originally was a food critic, you know, felt really trapped in that old world. And he was super inspired by what was happening in London and in New York, actually. And he was like, you know, they're having fun over there. Why can't we have fun with food in France? And you know, why do we have to be old and rich to speak about food? Anything is interesting. If you're into food, you can appreciate a Michelin-starred restaurant, but also a pizza truck and a bistro.
Right. And it's kind of ironic and interesting that, I mean, there was like a couple of articles recently on all the new young energy that's taking place in Paris, and some of that's American chefs that went over there and just said, wait a minute. I mean, you guys are a great audience. Let's have fun.
Exactly. Yeah.
So talk about what's happening with Le Fooding. So this is how many years now since you've moved into the States?
We started in 2009, so it's 5 years now.
So talk about this summer. So there's events taking place this summer?
Yeah. So it's the first time we do something at the beach here. It's
Which beach?
At Rockaway in Queens.
The beach to be, the big surf
Are
break.
You
take the subway out there. It's one of the best local surf breaks.
Yeah, and so what's fun, I mean, we really identified to the energy that they have there. You know, I don't know, I mean, you might be familiar with the whole new food movement happening in Rockaway, and basically it was nothing 7 years ago. And then surfers like David Selig and Andrew Phil, who started Rockaway Taco, thought, you know, we should have something to eat because there's nothing for the surfers. So they started a small taco shack, and all of a sudden get worldwide attention, you know, being called as the best taco in New York. And step by step, Brooklyn restaurateurs started to open things there. And now you have really, really good food in Rockaway. And it's great because it's also, you know, creating jobs and energy in the whole area in Queens.
Right. And Rockaway was tough. Those of you that may not have long memories or weren't paying attention, Hurricane Sandy was just, I mean, Rockaway took it on the chin.
Yeah.
It's where the beach was breached. It's the reason it had those great breaks and the reason that it works so well for surfing is because it's unprotected. It doesn't have a big dune system. And when Sandy left Rockaway, it was demolished. I mean, a lot of those businesses didn't open for a couple of years. A lot of houses were destroyed. That's where the fire happened.
Yeah.
That the fire department couldn't get to. I mean, there's still sections there that are blighted out. And you've also combined, I think one of the neat things with Le Fooding, I remember a couple of years ago, was you'd pair like an American chef with a French chef for an event. You still doing that?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, another, like I said, what's important for us is to sort of break rules and codes in the food world. And we feel like most of festivals and media always try to classify chef or restaurants. You know, it's either French or American cuisine or fine dining or street food. So we always try to just mix people that we find interesting. So this year we have, you know, a mix of people like Rockaway Taco, who are just super cool, humble, and pretentious, awesome taco makers, but also star chef like Cristina Tosi of Momofuku Milk Bar, right, or Enrique Olvera from Mexico. Ludo Lefebvre is actually the only French chef, and he's coming from LA. And finally, Ivan Orkin is doing it. So it's really a fun mix of
total all on the Rockaways.
Yeah.
When's it taking place?
July 11, 12, and 13.
Over, that's a weekend.
Yeah.
So how do people sign up? What do they do? They go to lefooding.something?
Yeah, so it's actually, everything is on legrandfooding.com.
Legrandfooding, okay.
Yeah.
So add with an E at the end? G-R-A-N-D-E or just G-R-A-N-D?
G-R-A-N-D.
legrandfooding.com.
Exactly. And all the info there, tickets are $40, so it's also very affordable for a food festival. And 10% goes to Greybeards, which helps a lot the whole post-Sandy reconstruction.
And you can take the subway.
You
one of the neat things
subway
about the Rockaways, because, I mean, every so often you'll see a kid with board shorts and a board or off-season,
yeah,
a wetsuit and a board, and I'm like, fucking Rockaways. The only one place you're going on a subway with that kid.
But, you know, that's what's cool. Like, I mean, I feel like it's one of the last areas in New York that New Yorkers don't know so well,
yeah,
and it's just a direct train. It's even a direct boat. So you can take the ferry. It's 30 minutes. It's awesome.
So $40 takes place over 3 days, and for that you get to hang around and sort of eat the food,
yeah,
drink the beers.
Yeah, so it'll be three chefs per day. We'll have a DJ every day. Nancy from LCD Sound System, who's a sort of a regular at the
Fooding. Wow.
A Ben Yacht from LA, and Chiba Matto, they're big foodies.
You've always had great music as part of the scene. Do you have, like, rooftop stuff in past years in Brooklyn, right? Or am I imagining that?
Yeah, and no, I mean, we've done a Brooklyn tour event and Red Hook things, and yeah. It's fine. I mean, again, you know, we were some of the first to sort of say there is no, you don't have to be a foodie to like food and to play a lot with musicians, and now it's very normal, but.
And you're doing these cool on the West Coast too, right?
So we did LA last year, which was interesting because it's a totally different food scene.
Yeah, and totally different space to deal with because it's sort of like,
yeah,
get in your car and drive,
yeah,
because
totally
mass transit almost doesn't exist.
But it was, I have to say it was hard to, when you're used to the New York pace, it was hard to work in LA because it's much more chill. But in the meantime, because it's only starting now, the whole foodie movement there, everybody was so excited and, you know, no one is blasé yet, but chef and events, and so it was super cool.
Yeah, we had Ben Ford on, Harrison's kid. kid who's got a restaurant out there, Ford Filling Station. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about the food scene, how much it's changed. And, yeah. you know, when he was a young man coming up, it was almost like if you lived in L.A. as a chef, you had to go to San Francisco to cook. And
yeah.
and now L.A. is really coming into its own as it's a great little food destination.
And the products are amazing.
Of course, California. It's like yeah. year-round growth cycle. What got you into Le Fooding to begin with? How did you get drawn into this world?
I mean, I was always into food.
But you studied what? You're a smart kid. You went to college and studied something else, art history or French literature. Or
yeah, I was in a school called Sciences Po in Paris, so it was a mix of politics and history and I mastered in communication. But part of my family was making uniforms for chef, actually. So I was always very drawn to this, and my dad is, you know, a great cook. So yeah, I came in New York to intern in fashion, and I was like, I really don't want to work in the fashion industry as much as I like fashion. So I became a waitress in a restaurant here, in a French restaurant in Soho. And I thought I loved the food industry, but really didn't want to have a restaurant.
Yeah, it sucks. So, it's a pain in the ass.
So I started to get interested in food writing and food, any food thing really that wasn't restaurants related. And I came back to France, started with Le Fooding, and 6 months after I got there, we were about to celebrate the 10th year anniversary of Le Fooding. So we were trying to find a cool way to sort of brag and, you know, celebrate. And so we decided to go to New York.
To do it in New York, to have that 10th one there.
Yeah.
How important is the movement now in France, Le Fooding? You describe it to me, because I really have no idea.
Well, I'm not very objective, but in objective words, though, we're now the bestseller guide. So Le Fooding sells more than the Michelin.
Wow. Because for years it was Michelin, and then there was Goemio that existed for a while, those two guys that had a publication, and I remember buying that, because Michelin was, I mean, it still is in a way, I don't agree with anything Michelin USA. When they came here, I remember doing some events with them and telling whoever the handsome, whatever the guy's name was, you know, honestly, this is a fucking franchise. I know what you're doing. You're just trying to sell shit. And you're expanding the way Zagat did, the way everybody did. You shouldn't be in New York because you don't know this city. Whoever your reviewers are, they're fucking clueless. Having said that, it's existed in France since the 20s and 30s, and it's always been considered kind of a gold standard. But weird because, as I mentioned, like Joel Robuchon, I worked with Alain Sandrins in Paris at Orchestrat. He was 3 stars for the better part of 20-some years. And they talked about, you know, how it almost felt like being held hostage to this. It was like walking a tightrope every goddamn year. Was the artwork on the walls good? Was the silver plate heavy enough? Were the wine glasses expensive enough? Was, you know, are we... And there was no recognition. It was like all at the top, and there was no recognition for just the people around the edges where creativity really flourishes. So you guys have just moved into that space and made it work.
Yeah, the mission made sense for a moment, but I don't think it evolved well with the times, and the problem is that they never rated chef based on chef sincerity. It was more about, oh, does this chef match with our criteria? So, you know, it's hard to evolve in that situation. Le Fooding, in the meantime, we never wanted to put stars or grades, because again, our interest wasn't into saying, oh, that's better, it's good. It was more about telling a story about what was going on. And you can compare Le Bernardin with Roberta's, you know, they're both awesome, but how can you compare stars wise and grades wise? So for us, it was really more about, yeah, celebrating chef criteria, like their own individualities and sincerity.
So the events, give us the dates again and the website.
Yeah, so it's July 11, 12, and 13. It's called the Fooding Beach Club. Presents San Pellegrino Fruit Stock at the Rockaways. And you can find all info on legrandfooding.com.
You go back and forth, and I haven't been to France in a while. What's the scene like in Paris, beyond Paris, in terms of the youth movement? Because when I think of how much I can speak of this city and about this city, because this is all I've ever done. I've been here for 30-some years. And, you know, we sort of watched the restaurant scene in New York move from uptown and formal in the 90s. I mean, places like Montrachet were sort of groundbreakers for being downtown and casual. Danny Meyer's Union Square